A Rayo Original Podcast.
Alan, you're 59. What do you think your biological age result is going to be?
264.
Do you feel 264?
I was brought here in a minicab, mm-hmm. and the minicab driver stopped and said, "You're going in there where that man's going." And I got out, and I went to the doorway that he'd pointed at, and it was a coffee shop. I was found by your producer wandering around.
Oh, no.
And at that moment, I felt 150 years old. But I think I'm going to come up older than I am. That's my fear.
All right, well, we'll find out. And you'd be forgiven because you've been through a lot. Alan Davies, your result is... Hello. Welcome once again to What's My Age Again? I'm Catherine Ryan, and this is the podcast that talks all about aging on the inside and out. On this episode, I'm joined by comedian and actor Alan Davies, who's probably best known for his unwavering commitment to being a panelist on QI, as well as the duffel coat-wearing magician's assistant, Jonathan Creek. His comedy career spans 5 decades, and he's 59 on the outside. But how old is Alan Davies on the inside? Like all our guests, Alan was kind enough to give us a sample of his blood so we can test his biological age and find out how he's aging on the inside. And Dr. Nicola Conlon, our very favorite, is here to interpret the results. If you want to find out how old your body is, then you can get the test at a 25% discount with the code WhatsMyAgeAgain25. Alan Davies, welcome.
Thank you.
One of my very favorite comedians.
Oh, you're very kind.
A wonderful man. I don't remember when we first worked together. It would be maybe 15 years ago, 12. Do you remember?
I don't remember. One of my first memories of gigging with you was I asked you to do a benefit show, and you said yes.
That's good.
And that was good and unkind of you.
Yes.
And it was for the city farm in Islington near where I used to live.
Oh, yeah.
That my kids absolutely loved. And they were having a bit of financial trouble. And all these people came and they're really good comedians, yourself included, turned up and raised quite a lot of money. And Violet came, I remember.
Yes.
She was backstage.
She was little, and now our girls are teenagers.
Yeah.
You have 3 children.
Yes.
Do you feel like they have aged you?
Yes.
Yeah. As much as they've aged their mom?
I did. More, I think.
It's a very loaded question.
I can't tell with Katie because she dyes her hair, and I think that's unfair.
Fine.
But she always has. I've known her 20 years now, and she always has dyed her hair, so I don't know what. Once she went to have her hair dyed, and it went wrong, and she came back kind of grey.
Yeah.
And it was very, very funny to me, but I didn't take a photo. I should have done.
We like the grey. Mine's a bit grey right now. We go for platinum blonde. So would you consider your hair to be grey?
Mine's fully grey. On Saturday, I did a show at the Lees Cliff Hall in Folkestone.
Ooh, not bragging.
And they had a picture. There are lots of pictures backstage of people who've been there before. And there was a picture of me there from 2015 without a grey hair on my head. That was the year the third child was born.
Fine.
And I think his impact was the most profound of all.
Yes. But I would say that this is platinum.
Uh-huh.
You could just rebrand it as platinum.
Okay.
And it's what a lot of young Hollywood women are striving for. And it's sexy on a man. This is what is annoying about men versus women is that all of the attributes that you get when you're older, we enjoy.
Oh, well, that's good.
Like, it's nice to be a man who's got a few wrinkles. It's nice to be gray. You haven't lost your hair, which hurts a lot of men's feelings when they do.
Yeah, I think I would have lost my wife if I lost my hair.
Do you think?
I think that would have been a game changer for her. I had some sunglasses for a while.
Oh, yeah.
But when I put them on, I look quite like Susan Sarandon.
Okay, not a bad look.
So, no, great look.
Yes.
I'd settle for that in old age.
What age are you now?
I'm 59.
Do you think 60... it's going to feel like a milestone. Does that sound old to you?
Yes. Okay. It does. The 6 in front is old.
Yeah.
Because it's legitimate to die in your 60s. That's you've had a life then, I think.
Okay.
And anything after 70 is a bit greedy.
Sure.
So, but at the moment, to die in your 50s, that's not good.
Yeah, that's a real tragedy.
That's not enough time.
Your kids are young. People will say, no. But you think 60's fine? I think 60's still very young.
Yeah, I suppose it's because when I was growing up, people did die in their 60s.
True.
No one really batted an eyelid.
I remember my grandmother, not to make this about me so early on in the episode.
Please do. I'm going to have a bit of coffee.
Go ahead. My grandma was ill, and she died at 63. And I remember her being afraid of dying around 60, with good reason. You know, she was ill. And I said to her, and at that point I would have been very young, 10. I said, well, I think you got a good 5 years left. And she looked, the look on her face, like, only five? And turns out I'd overshot by two. So yeah, 60s. But I think that in our industry, it is a little bit more difficult to confront aging because you go back to these clubs. They do have framed photos of you on the wall.
Sometimes they do.
And when did you first become well-known in the comedy industry?
Really, I think in my late 20s.
Yeah.
I started to get a bit of attention, getting on the old TV show. And then when I was 30, I was cast as Jonathan Creek.
Yes.
And then that took me really out of comedy and into a whole other world of people's living rooms.
Yep. And those photos will pop up and remind you again and again.
And I had really lots of curly hair.
Yeah.
It was my main attribute.
So I wasn't in the country when that was happening, but of course I knew about it afterwards. And I have heard you, I'm sorry to say, be objectified by a lot of people's moms for that hair specifically.
It's always the moms.
And I thought, what kind of show is Jonathan Creek? Lovely show. Really nice, funny, not as sexually charged as I anticipated from the reviews.
No. Do you remember there was a song called Sexy Boy?
Yes.
The chorus went, Sexy Boy, that one.
Yeah.
And somebody, I think it was at the Dave Channel or somewhere, they were running Jonathan Creek and they put a trailer together of clips of me, which they put into slow motion.
Yeah.
And they put that song over it. And it was intended to make people laugh.
Oh.
And it worked.
Oh. Okay.
So the sexy part was always been a slightly tinged with irony.
Sure.
You know.
That's not the impression that I got from the mums.
The sexual desires of mothers have long been underplayed. And I think they're significant and important.
Thank you. You've got a new book out.
I have.
A sequel to your best-selling memoir. Was it number one?
I don't know.
I think it was.
I tell you what I have found.
Yeah.
If you look at the Amazon website, which, you know, generally I discourage people to do so because I think they're rather too dominant in the retail market.
Okay.
But if you buy my products, fine.
Sure.
They have so many charts.
Yeah.
I have been number one in actors and entertainers' biographies.
Okay.
Also quite highly up in the opera singers' biographies.
Yeah, yes.
I know what algorithm was in play there. Mm-hmm. And comedy TV, they've got about 1,000 charts you can rank in. I think I once got up to number three after I'd been on the One Show.
Great. Well, it was a wonderful book full of all kinds of, I don't want to call them surprises, but I think knowing you for a few years before the book came out, I just ignore him. I mean, the first one. I did not know about the level of trauma that you had experienced. I had no idea. And I think that people were really drawn to kind of the juxtaposition of how funny you are. And they watch you to relax and feel good about things. But then you'd been hiding this terrible secret for a number of years.
Yeah. I really had. I mean, I had that was the kind of way I decided to tell my abuse story. And I couldn't tell it in stand-up at the time or in any other forum.
No.
And I really wanted to control it. And I went to Goldsmiths College and did a master's in creative writing. I wanted to go back to college. I kind of didn't really pay attention when I was an undergraduate. I was a bit cocky and stupid.
Just the hair.
and then I had really short hair then.
Oh.
And you know when I grew my hair out? It's because I had a girlfriend who said, you should grow your hair. And that was because her previous boyfriend had long hair.
Okay.
She was trying to recreate him. But then she showed me a picture of him naked once.
Oh, no.
And I realised that there was no possibility of recreating this
event. Oh, sorry. Okay.
That didn't last.
And see, you can make a lot of things funny.
I try to.
That's very dark and funny, but not this.
Well, I wrote about what my father had done to me as a boy.
Yeah.
And on this course, kind of anonymously. because when you submitted writing for to be assessed, you submit it anonymously with your student number. And that was the only way I could do it. And then I got some confidence from the feedback and wrote some more bits, and fellow students workshopped it. So it was still in hiding.
Yeah.
But it was in this safe space at Goldsmiths College, and I've really got so much out of that course. That's why I'm always name-checking them as a thank you to them.
Yeah.
And then I went on and published a book in 2020, and I couldn't go out and do book festivals and stuff because of COVID at the time. And this new book, White Male Stand-Up, is kind of part two. It's about having had some traumatic times in childhood, mm-hmm. how did that impact in adult life and in a career? Because I was really in denial about that for years. I thought the past is behind you and the future's in front. Didn't really realise that it's all happening at the same time.
Yeah. You know. And so this book, White Male Stand-Up, is a lot more about now and looking to the future in your career, but also kind of reflecting on how trauma has impacted that, the ups and downs, really, of the industry.
Yeah.
So I hear from a lot of musicians that their sophomore album is the most difficult. Did you feel like this was fun because it wasn't so steeped in trauma, or did you feel like, oh, I know what I'm doing now. I'm a best-selling author on a number of Amazon charts.
No, I didn't know how to do it.
Yeah.
It was harder, really.
Oh.
Because I thought, oh, I'll do a sort of showbiz memoir and tell, you know, hilarious stories from being on the Des O'Connor show or whatever. And then realised that actually going through your career is a bit boring even for me.
Mm.
Never mind a reader. But I realised what the book was about as I wrote it, which was my life had been about searching for family, really.
Yeah.
And so that was the focus of the book. And it's a book that I kind of got to be pushing 60 to really see back properly and to have had enough life to really make that kind of assessment.
Yeah.
But now I can sort of talk about things more broadly in my stand-up, and I feel like, I keep using this same metaphor, but I feel like if I'm a cake, I was previously showing, I was taking some of the ingredients out before I was displaying it.
Mm.
And it's nicely decorated, but it's not the real thing.
Yeah.
So I feel I'm more able to be me.
Did anybody know anything before you put it all in the first book?
I suppose so. It wasn't something that I really dwelt on with people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, Katie and I have been together 20 years, and she knew when we were married.
Everything.
Everything.
Yeah.
But neither of us really, I think, fully understood what impact it might have mm-hmm. on a marriage and on parenting. And it turned out to have a quite serious and severe impact. And what I didn't want, as I get older, was for my father to be acting on my kids through me.
Yeah.
And so doing a lot of work in therapy, Katie made me go to couples therapy for 3 years we went, with me kicking and screaming, really. And then writing the books and organising all that in my mind and for her and for me. And so I'd kind of written them for the kids, really, and they're not old enough to read them yet. I think they know what's gone on a bit because they can Google me.
Mm-hmm.
And my youngest, who's 10, has Googled himself.
Yes, he is.
And found a website in which his birthday was wrong. And reported this to me, livid. And I said, well, this is a good life lesson for you. Never Google yourself again.
Yeah. Then you know which one's the star. He's already Googling himself. He's like, what is my online presence? Where's my branding at, Dad?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think it's really interesting how you dealt with everything. And I love that a man and a really funny man and a really well-known man and a really British man has given this example that it's not too late ever to reveal your full self and to work on it, because I think a lot of people struggle to talk about stuff like this, and it does impact every single day of your life. And I know that it was probably re-traumatizing, like, to become a parent or then to reach certain age, you know, milestones where
certain ages is a thing.
Yeah.
Because when Katie was 38, which was the age my mum was when she died,
mm-hmm.
when the boys, my two boys, especially when they turned 6, which is how old I was when my mum died. It was seeing all of that really that brought a lot back. You know?
Yeah.
So anyway, you've got to try and deal with it somehow. I mean, in terms of how long it takes, there's a really good website, oneinsix.org, and one in six is the number of men and boys who've been assaulted or abused. It's pretty extraordinary. Yeah. It's obviously not as many as women, being that the overwhelming majority of predators are male, but it's still extremely high in number and more than I thought.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of good reading on there and a lot of good links to other websites, but in terms of how long it takes a man usually to reveal abuse, it's the average time is 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so that can be much longer, as it was in my case, to start writing about it at 50. And so I talk in White Mouse Stand-Up about having an angry boy inside me, as I characterise this angry boy, and how that might sound crazy to say that as someone who's nearly 60 years old to still be wrestling with it. But this is the reality of, you know, you can. There's only so much pulling yourself together and pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and striving on that a person can be expected to do.
All right. So you carried this around for a long time. One of the things that I know that Dr. Nicola Conlon, who is our resident scientist and going to join us soon to talk about your biological age, one of the things that she says about inflammation, which glycan age does test for, is that it comes from stress, it comes from trauma. Do you ever feel like carrying this around has had physical implications on your health?
Well, I think a couple of things about that. One is I think it affects sleep.
Yeah.
And so, and I know that's not good. But also, coping strategies that are developed by survivors are often reflected in their health later in life. So that really good book, you probably know, The Body Keeps the Score.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of talk in there about abuse survivors and about the huge amount of contact they have with the health professions, with medication, with addictions, drug abuse, alcohol abuse, smoking. So all of those things that I can relate to, and all of those things, of course, are going to impact on your life expectancy.
Yeah.
So I'm sort of aware that coping with and managing this internal hell is likely to have impacted.
And you started smoking at 11?
I tried smoking at 11. You could, in those days, you could buy cigarettes from a vending machine outside the tube station.
Nice.
And that was really good
for
wannabe smokers.
Do you remember how much they cost?
I think they were about 40 pence or something like that.
What a time to be alive.
Yeah. And when I was going to college at 16, which is really the best 2 years of my life, really.
Oh, no.
I really loved being at college. That was when I started doing drama, which I'd never thought of doing before.
Yeah.
And I found that being in front of people who were laughing gave me something that was I was lacking. Eddie Izzard lost his mum at six, and he said to me, "I think the audience is replacing the love of a mother." And I thought, nonsense. And now I agree with him.
Yeah.
But on the way to college in the morning, I had a little motorbike at 16 and I could stop and get 10 cigarettes. They started doing packets of 10 for 50p and that was a boon.
Wow.
So I smoked for 25 years. And then when I became well known and having a bit of anxiety about being recognised a lot and not really coping very well with fame, then I started smoking weed every day for about 9 years.
Wow, in the UK?
With no filters on. Oh, you could get it from a bouncer at a well-known comedy club.
Oh.
Most of the comedians you know who are addicts have that person to thank.
Is he still there? Is he the one that's still there?
I wouldn't like to talk about him any further.
Oh, but I'd like some cannabis, maybe. The really nice guy on the door.
And so that was, but I didn't really, luckily for me, didn't get hooked on any of the stronger stuff.
So this would have been like the 90s.
Yeah. And so recently, as is in my book, then I had a bladder cancer tumor.
I know.
And that is from smoking.
No.
Yeah.
How is bladder cancer from smoking?
Because the carcinogens are passed through, fished out by the kidneys and passed through the bladder. And
I see.
And so most bladder cancer tumours are from chemicals. that you shouldn't have in you. And the principal one is smoking, but also weird professions. Some professions are vulnerable to it, like dry cleaning, for example.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Chemicals again.
Yeah.
Just getting into the bladder somehow.
I think so. Luckily for me, they found the tumour and got into the bladder and got it out, and it hadn't gone through the bladder wall and gone anywhere else.
No. And how did you get it so soon? Because I know you're cancer-free now.
I got it because I noticed a bit of blood in my urine one day and Googled that, and it says, ring the doctor immediately. Do not pass go.
Yeah.
And... But what happens is the tumour ruptures the blood cell alongside it when it grows, and then that's when you see blood. But then the blood stops. So if you don't see it when it happens, if you happen to be using a urinal, say, and it just all goes, disappears. Right. So very lucky to have seen the blood, very lucky to have gone to the doctor, and they said to me, did you have any pain? And I said, no, which I thought was good. And it turns out that was bad. If it hurts, it's an infection, you can take some antibiotics, you're fine. If it doesn't hurt, they put you on a 2-week cancer pathway immediately. And it all happens pretty quickly. And then they test you and scan you, and then you wait for results, and then you think you're going to die, definitely. And then you go to very dark places.
Yeah.
Then there's a lot of tears and fear. And if you're lucky, very lucky, as I was, they get it out.
So that contributes to your pre-existing lack of sleep?
Yeah.
You've got a few things to be sleepless about.
Mm-hmm.
Did you quit smoking straight away or did you carry on for a bit?
I stopped smoking years ago.
Oh, so the bladder cancer was after.
Yeah, and you're not really clear.
Yeah.
From even 20, 25 years after you've stopped smoking, you're still not out of the woods, you know.
Oh, gosh.
So that was alarming.
Because why? Because the body keeps score.
Body keeps the score.
So let's go back to the 90s.
Yeah.
So you're getting cannabis off an unnamed... bouncer. You're super famous.
Yeah.
What else was going on in the 90s in like fun comedy boom Britain? Because I hear things about comedians in the 90s just having the time of their lives. It was like the best time to do it.
Perhaps it was. I think I loved being on the comedy circuit.
Yeah.
I loved it. When I joined the comedy circuit, which was 88, 89... it was still called the Alternative Cabaret Circuit.
Mm.
And the listings appeared in Time Out magazine under Cabaret. And the circuit was full of odd jobs and weirdos from all kinds of performance backgrounds, street performers and fringe theatre performers. Mm-hmm. But also lots of people with normal jobs who wanted to do comedy, you know, like Joe Brown was a psychiatric nurse. Or my friend Keith Dover worked at Ford's car plant in Dagenham. All kinds of different people. And everyone just wanted to do comedy. No one thought they were going to be millionaires next year. You know, there was no path through to, if you see somebody like Michael McIntyre or Lee Mack or someone, a primetime Saturday night TV, that wasn't us.
No.
That was other people. People, we just did it because we liked being funny.
Yeah.
And made a lot of friends then that I still have. And so I really value that time.
And did you have a proper job at that time or you were doing full...
I graduated at 22. I did odd jobs, weird things, washing up at Wimbledon tennis championships, things like that.
You were never a ball boy? You didn't run for the...
I would have loved to have been a ball boy.
I love
to
that.
To this day, I'd like to be a ball boy.
The energy, the youthful pizzazz that you have to have. The way they just dash out the gate like a Yorkshire Terrier.
Completely.
I know.
And they're high speed and then still.
Yeah.
It's like netball.
They're very regimented.
Yeah, they are.
Those kids.
Properly drilled.
Okay, so it was fun. When did it start to change and become more mainstream?
Well, people started to get on Channel 4.
Okay.
Channel 4 started to find people they liked and give them shows. I got put into a show called One for the Road, which mm-hmm. was a kind of a comedy travelogue thing. Quite a nice idea. Great job, because I went to all these different countries, but not very good scripts.
Oh.
So... that flopped, but it was my chance to do something. And if I hadn't done that, I don't think I'd have been auditioned for Jonathan Creek. You know?
Mm.
So, but other people like Joe Brand, Jack D, Sean Hughes, Reeves and Mortimer got their own shows on Channel 4. And Channel 4 was at the forefront of breaking all of us, really.
I mean, what do you think about what's going on with TV and comedy and all those aforementioned channels now? Like, they were the groundbreaking... comedy opportunities for people, and they spotted you and Joe Brand, like you said, and they changed the face of comedy entertainment. And then now, I don't know what an alternative comedy, it would happen on social media.
It's all different because of the internet.
Yeah.
And so you can see some pretty extraordinary and hilarious performance artists.
Yeah.
You know, like Natalie Palamedes or someone like that. Absolutely fantastic. But in another place, you know, in another world of entertainment, but can exist at smaller theatres. Soho Theatre, the principal supporters of these kind of performers. That's where comedy and theatre meets, really.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can find these people. But as you say, everyone's on the internet creating content. And I think there was a huge shift in COVID when, and for people like me, you know, 59, the idea of having a YouTube channel.
I know.
I mean, what? No, that's not going to work out, I'm afraid.
But you have farmed these children who are exactly the age that you need to show you how to monetize the TikTok.
Yeah.
Why did we have these children,
if not,
to get them managing our social media accounts?
I mean, I created a podcast in 2009 about Arsenal.
In 2009?
Yeah, and we were rating pretty highly in the fledgling podcast charts.
Like at the Adam Buxton time of podcasts.
Yeah, well, right at the beginning.
Where were you doing this?
We would do it, and my friend Chris is a radio producer. Oh. We'd do it in his front room. And he'd set up he would hang a duvet over a couple of lamps, I think, to deaden the sound a bit and create a mini studio. And then people assumed that if you had a popular podcast, and we had 10 million downloads or something.
Whoa.
For naught pence, right? If you had a popular podcast, you were a millionaire. And I thought, I felt like a footballer who played football before the Premier League started.
Yeah.
Don't you know? I had a great time playing football, but now I drive a bus.
Yeah. You played women's football.
Yeah, and basically.
You're like the original Joe Rogan. This new book, White Male Stand Up, is loads of this TV stuff, the ups and the downs, and everything else. Do you feel like a different man since you've been able to move into books, to talk in a more serious way about your life?
Yeah, I think it's been very beneficial for me and for Katie and for our kids. I don't think they know, actually, how much better off they are that their dad's done a bit of work on himself in his late 50s and had a bit of a think about things. I'm proud of the books, which is a nice feeling to have. Like, I really tried to do my best work, which I never did at school. Like, I applied myself to every paragraph.
Yeah.
This is the best I can do. And, I mean, even today, I was walking the dog and I saw somebody and I thought, that person looks familiar. And he stopped and spoke to me. And it was a parent from my kid's primary school. So I hadn't seen him for 5 years or something. And he said that he and his wife had been to a book event I did a couple of weeks ago at the Union Chapel, actually, where we did that benefit. And that she had read the book and something similar had happened to her as a kid and how much she'd got out of it. And they really appreciated it and wanted to say thank you. And that means so much to me. I can't tell you. It really is so rewarding to feel like you've done something worthwhile and still, I hope, found some humour in there to make it a readable, entertaining thing. So it feels like an achievement that I'm actually proud of. You know?
Yeah, books and podcasts really are really an intimate way to connect with people.
Mm-hmm.
And would you
especially
recommend
audiobook?
I was just going to say
the audiobooks of my books do really well.
To hear you tell that story would be such a different thing.
Yeah,
to reading it,
I
to have
to
your
a lot
voice
of audiobooks, and having that person in your ears. I love that intimacy.
And I see now that I have a husband, which you and I both probably thought I would never stoop so low as to. As to do that, I definitely see that one man's trauma becomes his entire family's trauma to navigate. And if a man is self-aware enough and brave enough to seek therapy and to change really the direction of his legacy, it just benefits everybody so much. But there's still people who won't do that. So if you could, not to give away all your teachings for free, but if there's someone else who feels that they have that angry little boy, what are some of your outlets for that anger now, would you say? Healthy ones.
Well, I don't know about outlets, but I do still advocate psychotherapy.
Yeah.
People go with a lot of preconceptions about what it involves.
Yeah.
A lot of anxiety about, I don't want to talk about myself, I don't want to... But my experience of therapy was the best sessions where I had where I would turn up and without anything particularly to say. I actually think my therapist, if I said I haven't really got anything to say this week, I could. He was very good at not flickering, you know, not registering anything. But I honestly thought it's almost a little eyebrow twitch where he thought, oh, this is going to be great. He thinks he hasn't got anything to say.
Yeah.
And I learned so much about why, how some feeling or thought can trigger some other thought from childhood or something, and why is there that connection? Why do you, if you say one thing and then you say something else, there's a reason for that link, what might it be? And so it was very valuable. When I first went to therapy, the therapist said, you're going to have to come every week for at least 4 years. Are you able to commit to that? And I said, yeah. And actually, I wasn't, because if I was filming Jonathan Creek, it was impossible.
Mm.
But he would offer telephone sessions. Anyway, I saw him on and off for 8 years. And there's a lot of things that you go through with a therapist. A lot of people turn up and waste the first year trying to kind of seduce their therapist or give an impression of themselves to them or try and win them over to their point of view. If you go in and say, I'm very annoyed about my girlfriend because she's this, that and the other. And then they have to sit and wait for you to blather on about her until she's eventually dumps you and then another one sadly takes her place.
Yeah. Sadly for me.
So,
yeah.
And so there's a lot to get through for someone in therapy before they realise. I used to go on the train to where he lived, where his office was. And the train went past the stop. So it's the only time this has ever happened in my life. Lots of people were at the doors waiting to get off.
Oh, no.
And we went through the... And then the train slowed down. And obviously the driver had realised what he'd done. And it just carried on to the next stop. So then lots of us got off. And some people were confused. Some were upset. Some were talking. And a few ran down to confront the driver and yell at him, shout at him. I presume it was a him. And I told my therapist this. Oh, this is absolute dream stuff for a therapist. How did you feel about the train stopping? Why did you not confront the driver? Were you upset? What was your response to this incident? As my response was quite practical, I went to the opposite platform and waited for a train back the other way.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed all those conversations, all that way of seeing my life. But then towards the end of our time together, I did say to him, I don't feel any better. And he said, would it be any other way, Alan, given what's happened to you? And that becomes a chapter in the book. Because in the book, I kind of recreate therapy sessions in dialogue form, which I quite like. I quite like writing dialogue.
Oh, yeah.
But I was trying to show how much therapy helped me and in what way. But at the same time, with the limitations of it. And what I think, really, if you've had some trauma and you're worried about it acting on your kids, is you have to be eternally vigilant. It feels a bit unfair, like a penalty or something that you carry. But you have to be continually vigilant about how you behave all the time.
Yeah.
Because you can really suddenly, something can snap and you can really upset people.
Yeah.
And the people you upset are the people who are trying to love you, you know. And because you don't feel like you're worth anything, though you feel like you're not lovable or to be loved, or probably the family will be better off if you are absent, which is a thing that you learn in childhood if you're the abuse victim in the house and the abuser is normally in the family or connected to the family, what you tend to think, a survivor tends to think, is this place would be better if I wasn't here.
Mm.
And that's a grim thing to grow up with. And because my mum had gone, and I know that she really valued me a lot, and I think that as I've written these books, I've had to think about her a lot. And other people have told me how formidable she was or how frightening she was. Her school reports, there were three references to her being argumentative in class, which possibly she wouldn't have been picked up on if she was a boy, I imagine. Mm. But I really loved that. That made me feel proud of her, you know.
Yeah.
And I know she had a sense of humour because she once put me in the bath with my socks on. And she laughed so much, I thought this must be the funniest thing that had ever happened.
Yeah.
And I was laughing as well. And I remember that. So I remember her laughing, and I don't remember her ever being cross, you know. But when that person's taken out, there's too much of a void to even think about.
Yeah.
You know. So, but I thought I understood what it meant to be bereaved in childhood, but I didn't really until I really wrote it all down.
I'm relieved that you remember your mom, or you remember some things about your mom, because you do hear about people losing their parent, and then your mind just looks after you by shutting it all away, and then you don't have a memory of her at all.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good that you do. Do you ever try to find the positives about your whole life experience, looking at everything wonderful that you have now and how smart and talented and funny you are now and how you help people now? Do you have almost a spiritual back reference where you go, well, this all happened to create the Alan Davis that, like,
well, you can't help
makes everyone
think
happy.
That way, you know.
Well, I think a lot of people would be quite bleak about it and wouldn't be able to see that. So I just wondered, you'd be forgiven for not seeing that because it just sounds so awful.
Someone did ask me, what would you change? And I said, I would have gone to boarding school. That would have been a good move for me.
that is
not
sad.
One of those hellish boarding schools where people are violently bullied and abused. Like a nice one with excellent pastoral care would have been my preference.
Okay.
But to get out of that house. But when you look back at your life and the connections, you don't know. You have one go round, right?
Yeah.
Was it a good idea to take the part of Jonathan Creek, or was it a good idea to be the regular on QI for 23 years? When you went on television in the 90s, people would say, I've done a couple of things. I'm going to take a step back from TV. I don't want to get on people's nerves, you know. You know, you could manage a career somehow in that way. If you were in demand, you could make choices. But nowadays, you have no choice. You're on TV every single day.
Yeah.
QI is on somewhere in the world all the time. And for that, I can only apologize.
I think it's a great choice. People love QI. Do you regret the way things went with Jennifer Aniston?
I really regret not saying something to her.
What happened? Tell me again that lovely story.
We were both on the same gala show for the Prince's Trust. And Jennifer Aniston had been flown over and was interviewed on stage by Joanna Lumley just simply because Friends was so hugely popular. And she came and she wore this kind of gown with spaghetti straps and this flawless skin and beautiful face and the hair and the sea. And I did a bit of stand-up about my dog. And she approached me at the after-show party, and I imagined that she was going to go past me and speak to someone behind me. And she's very beautiful.
Yeah.
And she said that she liked dogs. And I sort of, it was as if I'd had a stroke or something.
Wait a minute. She walked up to you, beautiful, stunning, this like gleaming cocoa butter skin. Is she really small in real life?
Not really small.
Oh, really? No. Actresses, they seem so tiny from Hollywood.
She was about the right size, I thought.
The right size. And she walked up to you and she just said, I like dogs.
Yeah, basically. I have dogs.
I like dogs.
And I didn't think of that as, I just thought, oh, she wants to chat about dogs.
Yeah.
And of course, what she was trying to do was seduce me.
Of course.
She'd chosen me, of all the people in the party, to approach someone who was about the right age, approximately the right size for her,
mm-hmm.
sense of humour, dog lover, hair. Mm-hmm. She thought, while I'm here in London, he could be the one for me.
Uh-huh.
And then, but what I did was I introduced her to the cast of Coronation Street.
Oh, no.
And that's a fate worse than death.
Said, if you like dogs, you'll love pubs.
And then a man came along, an American man, who looked quite cross, like possibly he was a Secret Service agent, that sort of vibe, maybe he was her boyfriend, and he took her away. I never saw her again, and the following year she married Brad Pitt. I mean, what did she see in him?
All right, Alan. Well, what are you doing to stay very well? I heard you've been cycling. I know you don't eat meat.
I haven't eaten meat since I was about 20.
The trauma could be bad for the test, but the dealing with it and the pescatarianism, very good for the test.
And I do like sun-dried tomatoes
a
lot. Do you know, I could eat a jar of sun-dried tomatoes a day, and I don't know why I don't. I still, when I'm doing the online shop, I somehow think of them as a luxury item.
Wow.
But actually, they're an essential. I'm less like that with beetroot. I regard that as a staple.
Yeah. Well, you must be very regular. I think you deserve the sun-dried tomatoes. I think it's very nice and humble. It's endearing to hear that you think, no, Alan, don't blow your load on all the sun-dried tomatoes that you want. But I think approaching 60, you deserve them.
I'm going to order 10 jars when I get home.
After everything you've been through, if not a jar of sun-dried tomatoes, then what?
Yeah.
What was it for?
I needed this talk.
What else do you eat?
I like cheese a lot.
Who doesn't? I mean, you are allowed some cheese.
Yeah, I try to go for vegetarian cheese because, you know, if you have normal cheese, a cow has to die, or a calf, usually, to make it. And I think that's a shame. So you sort of think it's a victimless crime, the cheese, but it isn't.
It's Handmaid's Tale for cows.
Yeah. So you've got to be, you know, mindful of the cows when you're making your cheese choices.
You do.
If you care about the cows. Although I was given the line in the sitcom Whites, which I did in 2010, where I played a chef, and one of my lines was, if God didn't want us to eat animals, why did he make them out of meat?
Mm.
That was a very funny line.
Yeah.
And the writers knew that I didn't eat meat, and they made me say that on purpose. Matt King, I'm talking to you.
He'd be cancelled today. Do you sleep well now? Now that you've got a lot of this out in the open, are you still sleeping badly?
I wake up in the night because I need a wee.
Okay.
And then I've struggled to get back to sleep.
How many hours are you getting?
4 or 5.
Obama, I think, gets 5, but it's not enough.
And I like a nap.
Good.
So nowadays I compare myself to Margaret Thatcher.
I don't see it.
I mean, we don't share any opinions.
Okay. Well, I mean, both of you are anti-milk.
She took milk away, you know. Yeah.
It's because of what it did to the calves.
Yeah.
Okay, are you nervous about the results of your glycan age test?
I wouldn't say I was nervous.
Nah, you've been through worse than this.
But I'm curious.
Curious?
Yeah.
You're 59. What do you think your biological age result is going to be?
264.
Do you feel 264?
Yeah.
If you could put a number on it, really, what age do you feel?
When I was brought here in a minicab, and the minicab driver stopped and said, you're going in there where that man's going. And I got out, and I went to the doorway that he'd pointed at, and it was a coffee shop. And it was actually on the wrong street. I was found by your producer wandering around.
Oh, no.
And at that moment, I felt 150 years old.
Okay.
Because she's quite much younger than me, your producer, and clever.
Yeah.
And almost had to lead me like a very elderly man.
Fine.
It's this way, Mr. Davis.
Oh, but you got here in the end.
It's a very impressive building.
And on your youngest day, how young do you feel?
I can sometimes, if I'm playing football, which I do with other elderly men, I can feel 58.
Oh, good. Okay.
But I think I'm going to come up older than I am. That's my fear.
All right. Well, we'll find out. And you'd be forgiven. Because you've been through a lot, but you don't eat meat. So I think it's about time to find out what your biological age is.
Okay.
We'll bring in Dr. Nicola Conlon. Alan, this test is carried out by a company called Glycan Age, and its results will be interpreted by a resident scientist, Dr. Nicola Conlon.
Hello.
Separately to our chat, you have filled out a lifestyle questionnaire, but Nicola has been listening intently. And she can shed some light on these results.
Okay, good.
Which could be as young as 58 or as old as 200, you said?
264,
okay.
Yeah.
Alan Davies, your result is 49, 10 years younger than your chronological age.
That's actually very pleasing.
That's very good.
Yeah.
Are you surprised?
Yes. Because as I say, I feel like I've gone through this life and lived another couple of lives.
I feel that too. I mean, you really have put your trauma, presumably, in the right place. You've done the work. This, I think, would be unheard of.
This is a brilliant result because we do know for sure that trauma, and especially there have been studies on childhood trauma, do push a person's biological age up that can last, you know, over their entire lifetimes. And the fact that yours has come back, it's 10 years, 10 years younger, that's really, really impressive. Wow. And I had a little look into some research about, you know, therapies and if there was any, you know, doing therapy or counselling, how that's known to impact biological age. And there's been no studies on it, but really interestingly, it seems that when people do therapies, whether that's counselling, talking therapies, and there was even some data on like expressive writing, that it can actually switch off genes in your body that are associated with driving inflammation, mm-hmm. which we know is what tends to push the biological age up. So I wonder if by you having your book is that kind of outlet that in itself has been a therapy that's almost literally changed your gene expression and really helped to take some of that, you know, memory of the body actually out of there.
Maybe it has. And, you know, I think also when I had a period where I wasn't doing stand-up comedy, when I was doing a lot of television, a lot of acting, and with hindsight, which is I talk about in my book, I think that was bad for me. Mm. Because I think stand-up for me was creativity and a form of expression, even though a lot of it was hidden still.
Yeah,
I was saying something and I was getting laughs and it feels great. You know this, Catherine. It feels amazing when you've invented a monologue and people laugh with you. So I
don't know it as well as you do, no.
You do. You're and very good at it.
That mother wound that you spoke about, Eddie Izzard made the connection between the audience becomes a mother's love. It is that immediate reinforcement. Mm.
So maybe that has helped me.
So when you buy tickets to see Alan Davis live, when you purchase White Male Stand-Up as an audiobook, hardback or paperback, you're helping to reduce this man's biological age, saving his life.
Do you feel like your sleep is better in later years? Or is there anything you felt different after?
I learned something about sleep.
Yeah.
I can't remember where. Maybe it's a radio program or something. Mm. Is it? It's good to have 8 hours or 7 or 8 hours if you can, but you don't have to have them all at once. Mm. Forgive yourself if you don't do 8 hours in a row. But if you can accumulate them over the day...
Fine.
And this is where napping is good. Yeah. You know, you can up that number. Mm.
And in your industry, we're very lucky that we don't work 9 to 5 at a place where you can't nap.
Yeah.
Unless you crawl under the desk and steal 20 minutes. You know, you can have a varied schedule where you can get sleep.
I really think that employers should provide nap spaces.
Yeah.
I'm not even joking.
No. You know,
somewhere where you can shut your eyes for 20 minutes, especially for all staff over 40.
So you're an advocate of the nap.
I'm an advocate of the nap and the talking cure.
And also...
and the sun-dried tomatoes.
Sun-dried tomatoes. How do you feel about those?
Oh, tomatoes are actually great. Tomatoes have something called lycopene in them, which is very good. It's like a really potent antioxidant. So it's a big tick.
Yeah. But you've got to cook them, haven't you?
You do. Yeah. There still will be...
Sun-dried?
Yeah, sun-dried.
Sun-dried sort of counts. Yeah. But the good thing about them is I get them... in olive oil. I mean, this is the elixir of life.
We love olive oil.
Don't get Dr. Nicholas started on olive oil.
Are you one of those drink a thimble of it on
little
the hour every
spoon.
Hour?
Not every hour.
Well, you know more than you let on. What other cheeky tricks are you doing to be 10 years younger than your chronological age? Because olive oil, I didn't know that until Dr. Nicola told me.
Well, I've thought for a long time, because I haven't eaten meat since I was 20, that if you can't pick something up and eat it, then don't. Mm-hmm. Right? That's my theory.
Right.
If you're a primitive human roaming around without access to, you know, supermarkets, stuff you find that you can eat, not the poisonous stuff.
No.
That's what you should be eating. And I think that our teeth and our stomachs are not designed for those, for meats. That's why we have to bash them and cook them and soften them.
Right, right.
To digest them. so we shouldn't be eating them. That's what I think.
And that would probably extend to ultra-processed foods. So
definitely.
You're not eating, like, Oreos off a tree.
No, and yet, but I grew up, absolutely grew up on cakes and biscuits. Yeah. My father is many things, but he wasn't a cook. But he had to cook breakfast for us in the mornings after my mum died. He had to do lots of things, for which I don't give him any credit in my books. But he had to do a lot of shopping and a lot of cooking breakfast, and he had to boil a lot of hams on a Saturday, because that's the only thing he could cook was a boiled ham. And then he would boil vegetables until they tasted of nothing, and then you put OXO on them.
Yeah.
So I had quite... I mean, it's an odd diet when you grow up in the 70s, because you eat a lot of terrible meats, but you eat a lot of organic fruit and veg. Yeah,
that's true.
So it sounds like you've got like quite a few things that you have been doing, probably without even thinking about it, that have been helping. And it's interesting because some of the studies show that when men in particular make even very small changes, it can have a really like profound effect, that you get a much faster return than women. And it's thought that women are slightly protected already from estrogen, but men tend to have like higher metabolism. They have like a kind of higher level of inflammation anyway. So that doesn't put them at the best sort of baseline. But what it does mean is that when men, particularly middle-aged men, make a change, they normally feel a big difference and see a big difference. So like the inflammation will go down. So the fact that you said, you know, you quit smoking, you took practices on to try and reduce stress, things like that, you're like aware of it, I think could probably be part of the reason why all these little things that you are doing are all building up and actually having a really good impact.
This is good.
Yeah, because also it should be mentioned that you were diagnosed with cancer, and we know again that's something else that would typically push it up, and also treatment can push it up. But again, in your case, completely, you know, gone the opposite way. So it's
that was a smoking one. That's if I had my life again, I would not smoke. Hmm. But
maybe it has been pushed up. Maybe you're 29.
Maybe you're 29.
Yeah.
And the other thing is about me that you don't know, Catherine, is I really like Brussels sprouts.
I love
cauliflower. And I can eat a bag of rocket leaves from the bag.
What?
I like greens.
See, I told
That's
you
That's just
good.
Lucky.
That is lucky.
Yeah. I probably, in a previous life, was a ruminative animal.
Yeah. Well, this is very impressive, Alan. Is it going to change the way you live your life in future, or are you going to just do more of the same?
I'm going to... I feel quite good. I feel better than I did when I arrived.
Do you feel...
Providing a service. Imagine if you said I was 79. I would have been really...
Guess how old I was.
I can tell by the way you're looking at me that it's older than you are.
77. I need to be eating rocket out of the bag. Give me the name of your therapist. I draw the line at cycling.
Yeah, I don't do much of that, but I love the e-bikes.
Yeah?
Yeah, they're really good.
I think your politics are keeping you young.
Yeah.
That's what I'm learning. A very conscientious, sustainable person. Has this motivated you to go even further into your health care? Are you going to be like, well, 49, I'm going to come do this and this, tweak this, take some magnesium, I'll be 39. I'll be 29. Nicola just called you middle-aged. When you came in here, you told me you were going to die in your 60s.
And be grateful.
Yeah.
I don't know about that. But I'd like to lose some weight.
What?
My BMI's too high.
Says who?
The BMI thing on my phone. And also, I'm pre-diabetic.
Oh, all right.
I have a score of 42. You know what that means.
Yeah.
42 is one over the zone that you should be in.
Oh, I can solve both those problems. Ozempic. Everyone's on it. You can get it from the bouncer at the Comedy Store. Sound good. Yeah. Well, I think that you've
can
done.
Can you smoke it? That's all.
Soon. Soon. I'll let you know.
You can put it in a vape.
If you smoke enough of it, a young Jennifer Aniston waddles up to you and says, I like dogs. You just tweak out for the rest of the day. Well, I really appreciate you being here. Congratulations on your young biological age.
Thank you.
Keep doing more of the same. Keep inspiring people.
You're very kind.
Maybe they'll stop eating meat and go to therapy.
They should. Definitely both.
thank you so much to Alan Davis for joining me on What's My Age Again. If that wasn't enough for you, his new book, White Male Stand-Up, is available with all good booksellers, and Alan's touring his latest stand-up show, Think Ahead, across the UK this autumn. Thank you so much for listening.
A Rayo Original Podcast.